The reason I wanted to record this interview was to introduce new generations to the important work and analysis of people such as yourself. In looking for teaching material on North American politics, I found your accounts to be precise, cutting eloquently to the point, especially in the two areas of Canadian and U.S. foreign policy, as well as North American integration. And a few years ago, you gave an excellent speech summarizing Canadian foreign policy. After being under the British thumb, Canadian policymaking transferred to the U.S. sphere of influence, and you stated, Canadian international strategy is largely driven by the U.S. relationship with the U.S. as a principal actor. And others such as Paul Heinbecker have stated that you have influence in the world if you have influence in Washington. And before touching on the U.S.-Canadian relationship, could you briefly in just a few minutes describe to us your view of U.S. foreign policy since the events of 9/11? What would you describe as the focal point of the U.S. policy, and how would you evaluate it?
Well, I think that 9/11 will go down as a, in terms of Canada-U.S. Relations, I think it will go down as a date of extraordinary importance. And the reason is that we were on the path of integration with the United States, and our relationship economically had developed in the 20th century as Mexico's has, to where we were overwhelmingly almost like a one client situation. United States was in the mid 80s before NAFTA, before the FDA. The United States was home to a destination for 80% of our global exports. So we were moving through FTA and then NAFTA indisputably towards a deepening and a widening of North American trade relations, economic relations, Canada, with Mexico following after the FTA. The FTA was the model for NAFTA. It continued in that direction, and I felt pre 9/11, I believe that historically this was unstoppable, that the depth of the integration would continue to deepen, notwithstanding the power of the lobbies in the United States, such as the softwood lumber lobby, to create great obstacles. However, I believed it was inevitable and would continue, and I thought that was a good thing. Nor did I think that in any way would subordinate Canada's foreign policy for the reasons that, to the United States, the reasons that could be deduced from that paper you refer to, which I gave a number of years ago. It was called the Skelton Lecture, and it's the first of a series that the foreign ministry had created. And I felt that the roots of Canadian foreign policy involved diversification to avoid the development of a kind of colonial status, a la Britain and the Empire. And so we were pursuing a diversification in our policy, such as involvement in the Commonwealth and La Francophonie, our historic hesitancy to join OAS, etc. But that the roots of independent foreign policy were sufficiently deep to be able to be compatible with and the deepening and widening of NAFTA. The 9/11 was changed an awful lot, if not everything. And the reason is very simple, security trumps trade. And thus the border became, the Canada-U.S. border became a source of great anxiety. in the United States. I won't get into Mexico. And we began to face an extraordinary challenge in terms of the movement, free movement of our goods in North America and our people. And so instead of, I would have thought that originally, by the time I gave that paper or after, that we would be moving towards a full-fledged customs union, as an example, 9/11 changed, so to speak, everything. And so we now struggle with dealing with the interdependence in our trade and the an economies which are already deeply integrated, but which nevertheless are likely to go forward in a significant way towards a deepening, towards a customs union or that type of thing, because of the deep, deep entrenchment of the U.S. concern, understandable concern about national security. So I think that I would regard that as a consequence of 9/11.
I think previously you stated that because of the Cold War that drove Canada and the U.S. together in terms of the special relationship in foreign policy, some people today, like Professor Stephen Cohen and others, say that we are in a new Cold War. Do you think if there was a new Cold War that would drive Canada back again with the U.S.? Or how do you see today's Canadian foreign policy?
I don't believe we can or will resist the closer collaboration and relationship of Canada and the United States on the security front. I don't think we would argue at all that terrorism and a threat to national security that comes from the radicalization of Islam. That we will continue to collaborate, as the United States will do with you, with Mexico and Europe, and that will grow. And it is a sort of speak, it is a type of Cold War situation, in that it demands a deepening alliance or collaboration. So that's something we're going to have, but I think that maybe the main challenge for Canada is concerned is that we will continue to deepen, continue to tighten the border because of the threat to national security, but we will probably not be successful in pursuing a deeper integration.
What do you think would need to happen? Because it doesn't seem like terrorism is going to be going away anytime soon. Mm-hmm. And what do you think could change this procedure, this deepening integration in the future, with this terrorism going on in the background?
Well, I think it's certainly theoretically possible. I mean, strong leadership could the part of the United States in particular could be overcome in time. The resistance to further integration, it is like, you know, because it is creates a larger and more competitive framework. I think it's in the economic interest of the United States to pursue further integration with Canada, with Mexico. I think that a more deeply integrated North America of Canada, United States, and Mexico would be an increasingly powerful, influential player. Make our continent more competitive too. These days, it doesn't take much attention to recognize the difficulty of pursuing a deeper trade relationship. I mean, NAFTA remains so extraordinarily controversial when it shouldn't be at all. But I think to me that could change. I mean, it could change that if there was a strong U.S. leadership.
In recent years regarding integration, because I think we see every few years there's this very slow process, but there is still this process. And it seems SPP failed. That would be one of the goalposts of this process of integration. But what other key focal points of integration do you see that were important and going forward? For example, we have 2010 and 11, you had the U.S.-Canadian Beyond the Border Agreement, and then the U.S.-Mexican Mérida Security Initiative. And in the report, the task force report on North America that was released 2 years ago, they state frequently that things should begin bilaterally where they can and then move trilaterally.
Well, I you know, I think that that's all true and correct, but the obstacles remain very, very formidable to a deepening of integration. And as I say, it would require powerful leadership. It would require that leadership not just in the White House, but it would require it in the Congress as well. It would require, you know, when we adopted FTA, first and then NAFTA, but you had some powerful leaders in the Congress and the Senate who were pro free trade and pro Canada U.S. Agreement. You had people like Moynihan and Bradley, and there was a deep commitment on the part of a number of very influential congressmen. Today, I don't know if that would be there. I don't know where they are, if they're around. But, you know, there is a reason for there's a reason for some degree of pessimism and skepticism as to whether the building of a North American community or whatever we call the deepening of NAFTA, etc., whether this is going to take place or occur. If I talk to you for a minute about this, and that is prospects for significant economic growth. In the case of Canada, we are somewhat different from a number of other countries, including probably Mexico, and that is the size of our the dependence that Canada has on the export of its natural resources. And we are seeing in the United States quite phenomenal development in the last few years, namely the movement of the United States concerns, the movement on their agenda from nowhere to the top because of global warming. And in the case of Canada, the depth and impact of this increasing dominance of environmental issues onto the agenda of the United States is quite significant. In the case of Canada, we are a resource-based country. We will continue to be. We have obviously had a deep economic integration in manufacturing, you know, in the auto pact and all that. Until today, I mean, Canada is still, relatively speaking, a significant manufacturing society or country. But if you look at the source of that, of our wealth and our prosperity, it has been development of our natural resources. In the case of the oil sands, that was a very technological phenomenon, because we essentially invented the concept that you could exploit the oil sands and make them economically competitive. So as Canada's significance of resources in Canada continue to grow, as the reality of Canada becoming a major, major exporter of energy, and we remain the most important source for the United States of their imports, that the intellectual, political environment in the United States continues to move in the opposite direction to our national interest, as I see it. There is the environmental movement in the United States. I think we've seen, by the way, that whatever we thought 20 years ago, or 25 or 50, the power and impact of the other special interests continues to grow. Much bigger now, I'd say, even when I was there, I'm hard to believe. So there's 250,000 people in Washington, basically. They're lobbyists or depending on lobbyists. And that's the third house of Congress, and in many ways the most important. So the big environmental movements in the United States have singled out the Canadian oil sands, and in particular the XL pipeline, as targets. And they, through their strategies and brilliant political lobbying, were able to block the development of the Keystone project. And Kerry, I think a couple of weeks ago, the very time when I think it was very shortly after Obama visited Trudeau visited Obama, Kerry came up with a statement. He said, there won't be any more pipelines. The United States, that's it. Well, we'll see. But that the full development of that environmentally driven foreign policy priority would mean that the Canadian resources are stranded. They cannot be got to sea any more than, well, you know, they have a few million. We have a few million barrels going right now, but if their future growth would be frozen, and they would in fact be stranded, and be more than stranded. They would be, because they would not be capable of being developed, because you can't get the stuff to tidewater. That in fact they become sort of placed on a reserve shelf for United States consumption at some future time, if the world, if the instability in the world, if the Canadian resources are regarded as a sort of antidote or counterweight to the instability of the Middle East, then the United policy on the part of the United States to, which, although they will never say it out loud, but that seeks to strand these resources, is probably in their national interest.
Plenty has been written about the positive aspects to deeper integration of our three countries, and we would become more prosperous economically. However, some see that in Washington, that Washington would have the greatest say when you take into account not only the sheer population numbers and the growing energy, as you just mentioned, but economic and political power. And often Mexicans believe, when we examine these issues, that Mexico would get the short end of the stick regarding political influence in a deeper integrated North America. Do you see any major negative aspects to a North American common?
On the whole, I think that the United States will remain the most significant market for any country that trades, whatever its problems internally of equality or whatever might be the flavor of the day. The fact is, this economy and will continue to grow in the United States, and it will be, not before too long, a domestic U.S. domestic market of close to maybe 400 million or even 5, viewing it now, if you add Mexico into it. And it's it will remain an open market, subject to what I just said, the consequences of the special interests using their muscle and using their constitutional authority within the Congress to deploy it. So in the case of Canada, probably the second biggest export industry we have is sawmill lumber. And as you know, I mean, since 1982 or 81, through activities through countervail and dumping and other techniques, and the second largest industry in Canada, export industry, has really had to operate under a kind of managed trade umbrella. And you never know exactly from essays going on now for 25 years. So, and that has to be one of the primary objectives of Canada, trying to get the managed area of managed trade back to free trade. But having said that, the United States market will still be unique, and it's because of its size. I think it will remain the number one priority. I mean, you know, I wrote a piece not too long ago and published in the Globe and Mail, and it was on the third option, which in Canada that meant diversifying trade with Europe, Japan, others. And I said that when the third option was launched, and when the first Trudeau was prime minister, some 60% of our trade went south, the United States. And after 10 years of third option, 10 years where the Trudeau cabinet enunciated or pursued a policy of high priority to the diversification of trade to third parties, everybody, you know, loved it and all in favor of it. And as a result, 10 years later, our trade dependency with the United States was much higher. It went up to 80%. When I look around today, and this is in the column, and you look around, kind of looks around, the fact is that it's still there, notwithstanding all the delegations and the priorities. And we have had prime ministers like Jean Chrétien, who didn't do a whole lot except travel the world selling Canada. Well, we may sell it, but we're not reducing our dependency on the U.S. market, and that's going to remain. So it'll be the national interest of Canada and Mexico to, you know, you're continually carving out a larger position part of the U.S. economy.
Okay, and one last question that I always ask our guests is, what advice or words of wisdom would you give to a younger generation of students, future political scientists, and diplomats?
Well, I'd have to say that the issues being what they are and so profound in the world today, that it's a very challenging opportunities there to help make it a better world, and that there's room, a lot of room for the brightest and the best to contribute their intellectual capacities to improving this. I mean, we are at the threshold of some huge issues that challenging the whole international structure. I won't worry with it, but essentially it is, in a very couple of sentences, the international system has been dominated for 500 years by Treaty of Westphalia and by international law at the time of Brutus, which put sovereignty at the top of the international legal structure. So sovereignty trumps human rights. And that has, although it barely is only the directions at that point are hinted at in the charter. The human rights movement came around after the charter, but it has grown enormously, and we have now the doctrine of R2P, mm-hmm. Responsibility to protect. And in the R2P doctrine, the human rights trumps sovereignty. And this is becoming, as we're seeing, increasingly the disintegration of many states. Or if that's not the best word, we're seeing the large portions of the globe falling into a state of civil war, which is producing extraordinarily extraordinary implications for human rights, human decency, quality of life, that this is what all the issues are about today, really. They're really the biggest issues, and that is what trumps what. Mm-hmm. So, we keep saying no more of this, no more of that, and no more genocide, no more Rwanda, no more Syria, but, you know, so making a better world is just a hell of a challenge. Mm-hmm. And it's up there with the importance of the environment, and it is the most fundamental issue facing the international community of how you accommodate these two concepts. So, if you're interested in international affairs, it's a fascinating time to contribute your abilities.